Ebbs and Flows by Tejinder Singh Heya. Imagine a map. A map of a bay. It's in the northwest of England, and it's defined in the further north by the craggy peninsulas of Furness and Cartmel, in the south by the coastal plain of the Fylde. In between, an estuary of changeable sands and mud. This sand space is orange on the map, seemingly solid with its place names. Jackie John's Skier, Aldrin's Hedge Balks, the Shoulder of Loon. But yet also tellingly blank in large expanses, as though it's too changeable to plant a name in the gaps that fill this fractal coastline. It's not a place of straight lines and firm ground. But this might mean nothing to you yet. You don't do maps. It's not the way you navigate the world. Or maybe you've never heard of this place and it's too much to hold it in your head. You need to walk around it. Experience it. Or perhaps you've lived here all your life and it's like asking a fish to describe water. Or maybe it's that there are a million different ways of knowing a place. How can you pick just one? Let's try, nonetheless. Imagine that the north of the bay is a hand. Your right hand, possibly. And the south is the left. Bring them together and then open them as though you're making the jaws of a crocodile. Then soften them until they blossom into the lolling head of a ragged water lily. Then imagine runnels between the fingers. Let the wrinkles become rivers and streams as though you're holding sand between your joined hands. Only the sand is flowing in and out with the tide. The light, always the light in this place, is flickering with the lapse of time. Somewhere down near the base of your palms, near the lunate bones, is the town where we are heading. If you were imagining an oyster shell with your hands, then you might call it the pearl. Only the rest of the people in the bay might object, and the people of the town might feel sheepish. The bay gave its name to Morecambe, not the other way around. The railway lines you can see on the map brought the holidaymakers from Yorkshire mills and Scottish shipyards in the 19th and 20th centuries. They rooted it, and the memory stays even after those guests have gone. You could call it the centre of the bay, if it's possible for a place at the edge of things to be at the centre. That was one way of knowing a place. But what of the people? If the map was alive, it would show tens of thousands of people moving around the town. What if you could hear the sea of voices from there? Put it to your ear, like a shell.
More than you realise. Yeah.
It's a place waiting to happen. It's just there.
I've been back to Morecambe after we've moved back to
Morecambe. In 1992, I was looking for a job, and you can probably tell I'm not from around here. I saw in the job centre they were looking for people to work in a holiday camp. Which
it's a place waiting to happen. It's just that
old and new are in the same place. Think about it. So I suppose it's a bit of untapped potential as well, because it's obviously
that's Morecambe. You know, like, I sort of quite like
so I still remember it when
but yeah, I'd like. It is a big. I have such mixed feelings about Morecambe because you have the back to the sea, and I hate Morecambe. If I face the sea, I say I come from Morecambe Bay. I don't say I come from Morecambe.
It's a place waiting to happen.
Whoa! One at a time, perhaps. Let's go to them. Let's go to them through a doorway into the air.
and a different bird's eye view, flying over rooftops that sag unevenly so that terraces look like waves, veering to the left over the long arc of the promenade, past artworks of your bird kin, past a statue of a comedian doing a dance to the sunshine, always the sunshine, carrying on and swooping until we are... Oh. Oh. Here. Imagine a theatre. A palace by the seaside. Weathered by the years. Precarious, perhaps. But clinging on. Because a theatre is a place of memory. And the Winter Gardens has the ballast of many, many memories, which require many tellers.
Okay, right. Well, I'm Peter Wade, one of the tour guides here at Morecambe Winter Gardens. And I remember years and years ago when I was growing up in Morecambe, the traditional seaside holiday still ruled the roost. So people would come here for a week or a fortnight. They'd stay in a boarding house and they'd be able to go out and see a live show every night of their stay in Morecambe. So they could have gone to places like the Palace Theatre, the Alhambra, the Royalty, the Tower, the End of the Pier shows. On it went. And of course, the one we're standing in at the moment, the Winter Gardens. And the Winter Garden's important because it's the one that's survived of all of those. All the other ones have either gone or they've been greatly altered. And the Winter Gardens are of them all, the biggest as well. So this is what we're going to go and explore.
Why start with an empty house of art? Why not a place of industry where economic benefits can be counted? A beeping supermarket, a busy warehouse instead of this haunted hall. Its vaulted ceiling like the upturned hull of a capsized ship. Perhaps because it echoes with a thousand small devotions, monastic acts of crafting in wood and words.
Well, I moved here in 1982. My dad worked at the power station, so we moved around the country. I was bored living in London, so I came up here. I never actually set foot in the Winter Gardens until 2020, till it reopened after COVID. Gone past it, came in, and I was just absolutely blown away by it. I went on one of the tours, which was actually by Peter, and I came off that tour thinking, I've got to do something to help. And I straight away signed up as a volunteer. One of the questions everybody asks when you do a tour is it haunted? Now depends on whether you believe it or not. They do say most theatres are. There's several stories you get recounted to you about people who believe they have seen or interacted with something. But all I can say is whenever I walk into this building, I feel like somebody's given me a big hug. And for me, that's worth coming in, giving up my time to help out and do whatever I can to preserve the heritage that we need to preserve.
Well, I brought you now into one of our upper boxes. And so we've got a grand view of the theatre, but not a grand view of the stage, because we get this very odd sideways view. And we, from here, we can actually look into the wings on the far side as well. That could be quite interesting if you had a performer needing to do a quick costume change. There wouldn't be time for them to get back to their dressing room, so they'd change in the wings. So you might end up seeing a bit more of your favourite star than you'd expected. What we do get a good view of is, of course, the auditorium. So we've got the big floor space below us, and that was the stalls area. Then above that, the dress circle. And above that again, we have the, well, some call them the upper circle if they were trying to be really posh, but actually most people call those simply the gods. And they were the cheap seats. What do I mean by cheap? Well, I always on these tours bring with me these, which are 6 Victorian pennies, and that's what that's the basic amount of money you'd have to pay to come in. You got a lot for your money, I have to say. So shows in the theatre here, access to the ballroom on the far side as well, sadly gone now, but after your show you could dance the night away in the ballroom. And outside at the rear was the Winter Gardens Fairground. So again, your sixpence got you entry to the fairground. And so my humble sixpence was described as the biggest sixpenny worth in the world. And who are we to argue about that?
Yes, there's been a lot of challenges. If it wasn't for people like Peter, people like Audrey, people like Eric, who come here, and Margaret, they all come here completely without, you know, any sort of salary or anything like that. They just come here to work for their love of the building. And I'm the coordinator. I'm very privileged and honoured to work with these people because they know so much about the building. As soon as you come in this building, literally, I came in. I think the reason why I came in here was I came to see one of my favourite bands, The Levellers, play about 3 years ago. And I thought, oh, wow, what an amazing place. And I've just fell in love with it ever since, and I've just been going to and through everything. And then the job turned up. I'd been working with museums before, and I thought, well, museums are all about sort of preserving history. This is about recreating history.
Now, you will be relieved to hear I'm not going to go through every single show, but I am going to go now to the final show. And that was in September of 1977. And it was a one-off concert by the Central Band of the Royal Air Force. It was a full house, apparently, as well, which made what happened then all the more poignant. Because at the end of the concert, the curtains parted and it was announced that that was it. The theatre was closing its doors. Nobody was expecting it. Not least a young lady up here in the dress circle. And this was a junior reporter on the local paper, a lady called Anne Clement. And she'd been sent along to do a review of the concert. But suddenly she was writing that week's big news story on the front page of the Visitor, which was the Winter Gardens was closing its doors. Anne Clement did something rather significant as well. Not a very shy and retiring sort of person. She shouted out, "Over my dead body," she said. And so began, where we are today. Because an action group formed after that night. And then a friends group formed eventually. And then what we have today, a building preservation trust.
Because if you go to the second floor, you know, where we've taken the doors off, I'll show you that as well. we've taken the doors off, because the spindles, they're all 120 years old and they're all in different areas and different locations. So we've now got to find a specific spindle for 1897, a specific spindle for 1925, a one for 1947 and one for 1985. And they're all holding the doors up. And no one does them anymore. You know, it's 120 years old, this building, and there's so many things which aren't in there, which you just, you don't see until, you know, you walk past and you're just literally immersed in the building, like, wow, everything is all over the place. But when you look at the, when you're in it on a regular basis, like Pete and I are, and we sort of see things happening, like that little thing down there, little things just make it really important to keep it going, because eventually people will understand that, you know, you've got to restore and protect and preserve things as much as break it down and start again, you know, and that's really important for us, and that's why we're here.
Well, obviously walking into this building, it gives me joy to come in and give up my time and just to see, bringing that history into the present for me is a massive thing. Just walking along the front and looking, because if you think about it, when you look over the bay, those mountains have been there forever and they're still there. There's no reason why Morecambe still can't be.
Like the ship of Theseus, or Trigger's broom, the theatre is in a continual cycle of renovation. Original parts are rediscovered, or new ones are made and become, literally, part of the furniture. It is a curiously coastal process. Things change, and things stay the same. But it's not the only place of memory here. The bay is full of many temples. And that outside is ever present in the Winter Gardens. The cries of gulls echo and they skitter on the roof. There are drafts of cold oceanic air. There is sunlight coming through cracks, giving the appearance of distant doorways.
And the whole bay is like a kind of, it's like a microcosm, supercharged spiritual location, you know, with the mountains, the sunset. You've got the Quaker movement started in this area, George Fox in Lancaster, and across the bay in Swarthmore Hall, you've got the Buddhist temple across the bay, and you've got this whole kind of history of movement of, you know, natural and divine and human. So it's very inspirational, that.
So yeah, I think there's lots of magical areas, and I just think Lancashire deserves to have that put back on the map.
And of course, Morecambe Bay is made by the moon, famously, and controlled by the tides. So yeah, there is that very direct link.
Yeah,
there's actually two stone circles. There's Burke Rig and the Druid Circle up near Rotherstone, just the other side of the bay.
I've walked across, I've done the Cross Bay Walk a couple of times, and that feels really strange. It feels biblical when you get halfway, because you just think, if the sea rushed in, that would be it. And it reminded me of a picture I had in a children's Bible, the parting of the sea, and you just think, oh, we're at the mercy of nature here. Are we really safe to carry on across this walk? I mean, you wade through it. If you're 5'4" like me, you're up to your waist in it as you walk along.
I launched my interreligious DSS art flat in Morecambe with a call out to people from all faiths, artists to come and have a residency and produce work. And it's that kind of like global and local, where we have influences from all different religions coming into a single place. But it felt that Morecambe was that place because of that sun element and that sunset, the sun, the sky, the water, the mystical, the divine, everything coalescing, you know.
Perhaps it's not easy to talk about the spiritual in England. Perhaps it's not easy to talk about the difficult love you might have for your hometown. Perhaps it's easier to favour everyday prose rather than poetry. Maybe that's why you talk about the weather with a stranger rather than mentioning the sadness in their eyes or the dance in their steps. Only the weather in this place can have its own way of unlocking things.
I mean, I love the sea most of all when it's got the wind behind it and a storm, and the days when you're told not to go out are the best days to be out and actually feel the weather and the power. And I kind of like that it stays wild.
I loved looking out at the sea. I loved being, you felt like you're part of the weather. Because when a storm comes in, you can see it coming. You see it's coming from Barrow and you think, oh yeah, that'll be here in about half an hour or whatever. And I remember one storm just before I moved out where the sea was so violent, it threw a starfish onto my path. And it's like, you realise the force and the power of the sea when you're living close to it and looking at it. And also, you realise the danger because people would get stuck in the mud. Sadly, some people would purposely walk into the sea. I remember having to ring 999 once because I could hear someone crying out on the rocks. So you have this very dramatic landscape that when the storm subsides, you think, oh, it's quite flat, it's quite there. But what's unique about the sea here is that you don't just stare out at nothing. You stare out and there's hills. You've got this beautiful landscape to look at as well. And I think that's really, when I look at that and look at other bits of the sea that I've lived near, that is what is the most beautiful thing.
Off the clean curve of the promenade and onto the beach. The crinkled line between sand and sea. A line that's not a line, but is, instead, a conversation.
I think years ago when I started swimming, there's always like trepidation, like going into the unknown. So when I started out swimming, I was always very nervous in the sea, and I'm going into something where I'm not in control, and I'd have like a sort of knots in my stomach and think, I'm excited to go in, but there's just that element of like what might happen to me and what might be in the water. And because I used to swim in the river, and that was quite, not, what's the word, when you know what's, you could sort of guess, it's a narrow river, it's quite predictable. But when I'd gone from that to the sea and it's wide open, it was like, this is a whole new level. And I think now it's like more excitement, hey, let's do this. And it's, I know it quite well now, so it's not that same level of, oh, what might happen, but still a kind of excitement, I guess. Like, I'm going into something, a different place where I'm out of the ordinary, I guess. And I think when you go down to the beach, especially when you put a wetsuit on, I think people tend to look at you a little bit differently. And even now, there's quite a lot of people swimming around here. You still get people pointing. It's a bit of an attraction at times. And I think some of them secretly try to film you. And they try to act like they're not, but I think they want to take a picture and show them, look what I saw. And, but I don't know, changing into that wetsuit, I think it's like, I feel different. Like, I don't know how. I don't know if you've ever worn a wetsuit for swimming, but it's hard to get on, but you can float effortlessly, and I suppose it's not, I don't think, it doesn't make me feel like invincible, but I feel like I've got a second skin on where I'm in a, like I can float and it's all effortless, and I just feel different. I don't know exactly how. But
walking on the flat expanse of the sands, the unnamed spaces on the map. Yet there are memories here too, miraging into existence, slippery as fish, and just as precious.
My granddad was lived around the corner. I lived in Bear, and granddad lived on the promenade. He was a train driver, but he also used to have set lines in the bay. So there are channels of rivers that come into the bay, and they create channels in the sand. And those channels, he would knock heavy pegs into the bank around the channels when the sea was out, and set a wire across and hang from it a series of nylon string with hooks at the bottom. And as the tide came in, he would bait them with ragworms, which he'd dig out of the sand. And as the tide went out, he'd follow the tide out. And I used to go out with him quite a lot and used to de-hook, he'd take all the fish off the hooks, and then he used to hawk them to fish shops in the town, well, in Bear actually. But that was a really sort of fun memory, because it was it was an incredible thing to do, but it was normal and local, you know. But thinking back, it's really unusual, you know. We used to walk out into the bay and collect fish.
The other thing is, when you're half netting and you stood in the water morning, noon and night, through the nights even better, what you see is unbelievable. You see not one or two shooting stars, you see thousands of shooting stars. You see upside down rainbows. You see fish flipping and swimming around at the night. You see ducks chasing one another backwards and forwards with the phosphorescence in the water, and all the water sparkling just like something out of Disneyland. It's an experience that you can only can tell you that you have to have it to appreciate it. And I appreciated it, and I've done it for all those years. And sadly now, as I'm getting older, I've realised, at 73, it's time that I gave it a rest. So this 18-foot six pole is going to have to go to rest, but the thrill and everything that goes with it has been unbelievable all my life. I couldn't have wished for a better life.
Well, the jellyfish on Saturday when we walked down, and we'd gone for a walk about 8 o'clock in the morning, and you could see them glistening on the beach, and it was just filled, and I was like, oh, there's loads. And then when I went down with the children on Monday, I thought, there isn't any. I can't see them. They're not glistening. But then when we went onto the beach, there was lots. It was just the way the light had caught them. So they were there, but they weren't shining. Reflecting.
Time gathers in an estuary. The new and old flow in and out of each other. First words and last. Imagine a map. A map of a bay.
Ebbs and Flows by Tejinder Singh Heyer. Narrated by Helen Longworth. Director and sound design, Stefan Eskreet. With the voices of John Ghiberdi, Emily Griffiths, Janet Hampson, Graham Hartley, Lauren Jones, Jude Kellett, Maury McDermott, Giles Metcalf, Pete Moser, Aniran O'Neill, Audrey Oldham, Margaret Owen, Trevor Owen, Peter Wade, Jackie Wilson, Neil Wilson, and Rick Woodstock. Guitar music by Andy Raven. Produced by Joe Carruthers, with assistance from Jill Wormsley and Izzy Hogmaskell. With thanks to all at the Winter Gardens, More Music, and all the residents of Morecambe who contributed. Ebbs and Flows is a Ragged Edge production in collaboration with Lancaster University, funded by the Joy Welsh Postdoctoral Grants Fund.